This episode is brought to you by Rosetta Stone, the all-in-one language app. With Rosetta Stone, you'll have everything you need to learn a language and use it in the real world. They offer immersive lessons, writing prompts, and engaging activities to prepare you for real-life conversations. You can pick and choose the lessons that work best for you and create a personalized experience that's both fun and engaging. Get ready for life's adventures with 50% off for I Know Dino listeners at rosettastone.com/dino. Hello and welcome to I Know Dino. I'm Garrett.
And I'm Sabrina.
And today, in our 328th episode, we have a bunch of news, including a new raptor named Sri Devi, which I think is really, really cool. I'll get into that more later, obviously, but it's awesome.
Raptors are cool.
Yeah, this one especially. And the name is awesome. I don't have any sauropod papers this week.
Oh, bummer.
There have been too many sauropods lately.
You can never have too many sauropods.
We were having too many sauropods.
Nah.
They're named after like single vertebra and stuff like that. It's time for some other dinosaurs.
I mean, there's always room for other dinosaurs, but
not when the sauropods are taking up all the news.
I mean, they're big. What do you expect?
Well, this week, we're taking a break from sauropods.
Mm. Oh, except for the dinosaur of the day. That's a sauropod. It's Lesimosaurus. That one's a request.
So that one's not your fault? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Pawn it off on somebody else. Fill it up the show with sauropods.
Can never have too many.
But speaking of patrons and dinosaur requests, we have our weekly shout-outs that we like to give. And this week, we're thanking Greg, TRX Dinosaurs, Melina and Manoli, the Tolbert family, Leah, Michael, Argentrinosaurus, Neil Ovenator, Stego Steve, and Vikram and Karthik.
Yeah, thank you so much for all your support. We really appreciate it. And keep those dinosaur requests coming. And they don't all have to be sauropods, but it's nice.
They don't have to be sauropods, but Sabrina won't object if it's nothing but sauropod requests. I might object.
Yeah, we don't have all sauropods. We've got quite a backlog, actually.
And they're not all sauropods?
Yes.
Okay, that's good. Glad to hear it.
And I'm not just picking and choosing the sauropods, just so you know.
You're going in order.
Well, I'm trying to go in a way that is fair to when they were requested. I'm trying my best. So it's a little bit randomized.
Gotcha.
Yep. Anyway, if you want to join this growing community and put in a dinosaur request, then check out our page, patreon.com/inodino.
So we're going to start off with our new raptor, which is so cool. I really like this one.
Because it's a raptor, or there's something especially cool about it?
The name is especially cool, and the raptor itself is pretty cool in some specific ways. But really quickly, for a little bit of background, the article was published by Alan Turner and others and published in the American Museum Novitates, which is kind of a weird name, but Novitates is Latin for like new acquaintances or something.
Hmm.
So I guess it's like new things that you're learning, new friendly thoughts, I guess.
That's fitting for a journal.
Yeah, as AMNH's, I think, main journal, if I'm not mistaken, at least one of their journals. Specifically, this one's about a new dromaeosaurid, also known as a raptor, from Mongolia, but it's not really that new of a find. It was actually found in 1991, which was apparently during the first, quote, full-scale expedition that was between the Mongolian Academy of Sciences and the American Museum of Natural History in the Gobi Desert.
Cool. I guess that makes sense because the American Museum of Natural History had been going to the Gobi Desert for decades at that point.
Yeah, I mean, like 7 decades about, because Roy Chapman Andrews went there back in the 1920s for the first time, and he was with AMNH at the time. And they've got pretty good relations now in general between AMNH and Mongolia. They had that moving museum of Mongolian exhibits around the city of New York for a while in that RV, and then they moved the RV over to Mongolia so that they could teach people in like rural parts of Mongolia who couldn't make it to the museum. They're bringing the museum to them and all that cool stuff. So yeah, there's a lot of nice interaction that's been going on between AMNH and Mongolia, including some of the repatriation of fossils by people like Roy Chapman Andrews, who went from the U.S. to Mongolia and then brought fossils back to the U.S. And now some of them are ending up back in Mongolia.
There's also the Institute for the Study of Mongolian Dinosaurs run by Ballora, and she also works at the AMNH.
Yeah, that's true. It's like a a personification of the relationship between AMNH mm-hmm. and the Mongolian Academy of Sciences. But I don't think they've been successful in making their new dinosaur museum yet. So the fossils are still housed in sort of other museums that aren't as natural history focused as they maybe could be. And I'm guessing that until they have a bigger museum space, a lot of the fossils will probably end up staying in AMNH for a while. But speaking of Roy Chapman Andrews, mm-hmm. I learned while I was researching this that he is a Wisconsinite.
Oh.
Because I keep track of all the famous people from Wisconsin since I'm from Wisconsin.
There. Yeah.
Yeah. So add him to the list. He's a good one. I also found out that he is supposedly one of the people that Indiana Jones is based on.
Oh, that makes sense because I think he wore a similar hat. Or Indiana Jones wore a similar hat to Roy Chapman Andrews.
He had a very similar vibe. But then some of the stuff I was reading was saying that it might be based, Indiana Jones might be based on him, but indirectly because his sort of style kind of informed this general sort of idea about what these paleontologists and archaeologists that were going out in the field looked like.
Mm-hmm.
And then other people had depicted that in various ways. And then people like George Lucas might have seen that and then sort of incorporated that in. So it's kind of like a couple steps removed from Roy Chapman Andrews himself. They've never officially said that it's based on him in any way.
It's not the same as Alan Grant.
No, because that one I think is literally based on basically Phil Curry and Jack Horner.
Mm-hmm. And a little Bob Barker.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense too. Yeah, they all kind of have a similar, I mean, you need the wide brim hat if you have a fair complexion and you're out in the sun all the time, like mm-hmm. me. I've got my share of wide brimmed hats. And then obviously, you know, why not? You're going to wear jeans and whatever. It's yep. kind of an obvious getup you might have. Lots of pockets are useful.
Right, right. A similar attitude of you're happy to be out there.
Yes.
In rough conditions.
Yeah, exactly. You got to be very go with the flow when you're out in that kind of situation. So yeah. Definitely a personality type that gravitates to that kind of work. But I think we should do a full in-depth episode on Roy Chapman Andrews at some point because there's so much to say about him. I know you've covered him
in bits
here and
pieces,
there.
Yeah.
Especially with some of the dinosaurs of the day where he was doing something specific.
Yeah.
There's like an anecdote related to it.
That's true. And he made some really big discoveries.
Oh, yeah. And it was literally the first dinosaur excavations in Mongolia. I'm pretty sure that's true. I tried to find if there was anything before that, and I think he was the very first person to go there as a paleontologist and dig out dinosaurs knowing that they were dinosaurs. I'm sure someone had dug out a bum before then, but not in a scientific context.
There's some reason that brought him there.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah, it could be. And who knows? It probably wasn't even dinosaurs. We'll have to look into that, but it seems like a lot of times they're looking for mammals and
yeah.
they end up stumbling onto dinosaurs.
Mammals or really old humans, specifically. I guess that's mammals too.
Yeah, but I know what you mean, because they would have known that it was older than early humans, presumably. Mm-hmm. So back to the new dinosaur, after our little Roy Chapman Andrews aside. The really cool name that it has, Shri Devi, is actually the genus and species. So the genus name is Shri, and the species name is Devi. And it's spelled in a way, because it's D-E-V-I, where normally you might say it's like Devi or Devi. But since Shri Devi is a proper noun of something, I think that's probably a better way to pronounce it, kind of like Yi Chi. You don't say Yi Chai or something, even though a lot of times species names end in an I sound. So Shri Devi with a capital D, the lowercase d is the name of the dinosaur, with a capital D, it's, quote, Sanskrit for a female protector deity in Tibetan/Mongolian Buddhism, end quote.
Mm.
Which is cool. But the description, they include a piece of artwork about it. I think it's a painting of Shri Devi. And they have a description about what the piece of artwork is, which is just brutal. So they say, Shri Devi, quote, rides a horse or donkey across an ocean of blood. Her accoutrements include a saddle of flayed human skin, the book of the law, and the dice of the fortune, end quote.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is intense.
Everything I read about this deity is like just the most vicious goddess you could imagine. It's described as like the type of vengeful god that's like imposing the rule of law, basically. You know, they've got the law book there. So
yeah.
They're the bad cop in the good cop, bad cop equation for sure.
I was thinking like powerful and yeah, along those lines.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely very powerful. And I think that might be because this is a raptor, and raptors are usually thought of as like pretty aggressive and things.
Mm-hmm.
But specifically, Shri has a sickle claw, which is proportionately larger than velociraptors.
Ooh.
And I think that might be what they're sort of going for with, right, like it's a little more ferocious with
it's
a larger
using
claw.
That claw.
Yeah, exactly. So before I get into all the rest of the description of it, I want to talk about that claw a little bit. Relative to the metatarsal foot bone, that's how they compared it, because velociraptor and Shri aren't exactly the same size. So they wanted to compare it to a specific other bone. So foot bone makes sense. It's right by the claw. Shri's second claw, which is that big, long, curved claw that all raptors have, is actually longer than that foot bone.
Wow.
So it's like if that last digit on your finger was longer than like your foot, basically. So this is a massive claw. It's 91 millimeters or 3.6 inches along the outer curve.
And that's just the claw bone.
Yes, exactly.
That's not the probably keratin sheath around it.
Correct. Yeah, they say there are prominent claw sheath grooves in it, which are a good reminder that it does have that much larger keratin sheath that goes over it and would make it a lot sharper and all that. So I don't know. They didn't give a guess at how big that would be, but we've seen some pretty large estimates before. So maybe it could be almost half a foot if you include that element.
Oh my gosh. So I can imagine it probably kept this claw off the ground, as they often did. And it was probably used to it. That's just how things were. But that would be so annoying.
Well, it's on its foot, too. So, like,
Can you imagine, though, it's totally different with the way our feet are. But if you had to, maybe like your second toe, you had to keep it lifted while you were going about your day.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah. So partly what they think is that the sort of neutral position of the claw was held up because there's this big muscle attachment point on the bottom of it, which is for basically pulling it downward. So default position is kind of up.
So it takes effort to push it down.
Exactly, yeah. And you can see on this one, it's got this huge bump on the bottom. I mean, they all basically have a huge bump on the bottom of the claw, which is where that muscle would pull back and then jam the claw downward when they pull. So yeah, the default is up, if that makes it any better.
Okay.
But then that it does mean that they largely are balancing on two toes, and their footprints are basically two-toed prints, whereas other theropods usually have three-toed prints.
Mm-hmm.
So that part is a little bit trickier, potentially. And maybe, I wonder, that could potentially be a limit on their size, because if you're using your feet as a weapon and you're sort of limited in how much foot area you can have on the ground, it might make you slightly less stable if you're several tons of weight. And just for the record, the velociraptor claw is about 65 millimeters or 2.5 inches without the sheath. So this is about a third bigger. But at first I was thinking, okay, well then velociraptor is smaller than Shri because its foot bone is smaller. But actually, if you look at the rest of the bones in velociraptor versus in Shri, their femur lengths are similar and their lower leg bones are similar. So it seems like they're around the same size. So the fact that Shri's
it's just
claw,
so much bigger.
Yeah, it's like a third bigger than velociraptors, even though I think they're about the same size. They didn't give any specific size estimates for the whole animal, so I had to base it just on that hind limb estimate. But
I've been watching a lot of anime lately, so in my mind, I've got an image of a velociraptor type with the much bigger sickle claw just extending its leg out at a kick with those like anime lines.
Yeah, that's a pretty good idea because it is a very close relative of velociraptor. So if you take velociraptor and you give it like a slightly longer claw, there were some other little differences in proportions in the leg. But yeah, I think just depicting a velociraptor with a longer sickle claw, that's a pretty close approximation of what Shri was. Unfortunately, they didn't do any histology to check the lags, so we can't be sure about its age, and they also obviously can't see the structure of the bone, too, if there weren't any lags.
Right.
So we don't know if it was an adult or if it was still growing. They also didn't mention bones that had fused to indicate whether it was an adult or not. They talked about some bones that hadn't fused yet, but basically they were saying, like, and a lot of times those bones don't fuse in dromaeosaurids. So there wasn't a whole lot of stuff about how old it was, you know, as an individual. One of the really interesting elements of it is the specific formation it was found in. So it was found in the Baran Goyat Formation. I hope I pronounced that right. That's the formation that's in between two other layers that we talk about all the time. So it's more recent than the Jadokta Formation.
Mm-hmm.
I know you talk about that one a lot in Dinosaurs of the Day. That one's 75 to 71 million years ago. That's where Velociraptor, Oviraptor, and Protoceratops, and tons of other dinosaurs are from.
The really famous ones from Mongolia.
I think so. But the Nemegt Formation is also very famous.
Mm-hmm.
That one's about 70 million years old. And that one has Mononychus, Gallimimus, and Tarbosaurus.
Mm-hmm.
So it's right in between those two. And there's not a lot of time in between those two because one of them's 71 to 75 million years ago and the other one's 70 million years ago. So it's like very roughly 70 to 72 million years ago. And I kind of wonder about the Nemegt Formation because almost everywhere I looked said it was 70 million years old, but it didn't give a range. It seems like, could the whole formation really just be 70 million years old?
It's too specific.
It feels too specific, yeah. And some places would put date ranges around things that were in the Nemegt Formation as 70 to 66 million years ago. Other ones would say like 71 to 70. So I don't know. I'm not sure if people are still working on precise dates of the area, or maybe we have very precise dates and that's how they know it's 70 million years. But in any event, we know that Shri was in between these two because you can see in the layer cake of the sedimentology that this one's right in between the two. We just don't know the exact age of Shri. It's somewhere, the authors put it basically 71 to 72 million years ago.
That's pretty good because sometimes you have very large ranges.
Yeah, it can be like 20 million years for sure. And Shri, the individual, the fossilization is really beautiful. It seems like every Mongolian find I see, I'm just like, oh my God, this thing is so gorgeous.
I see why you think it's so cool, because the name is cool. This gigantic sickle claw is cool. And the condition it was preserved is really good. So
yeah, it was, it's so cool. It basically looks like a lot of the Mongolian stuff where the fossils are preserved in sort of a whitish color. So they look more like, every time I look at them, I think it looks more like a modern animal. It looks more like a real bone that you'd find on the ground than like a fossil when they're brown or black or some other color where they've clearly changed a lot over the years. These ones always look so much more realistic, like a modern bone. And then on top of that, they're always just in sandstone. You don't see all the scrape marks from really difficult preparation out of it. It looks like it just pops right out of there.
Kind of like that one dinosaur skeleton in Star Wars.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but it wasn't supposed to be a dinosaur skeleton.
Oh, like, right. But it looks
supposed to be like a dragon or something.
But it looks pretty dinosaur-y.
Yeah. Well, it was a sauropod, right? I think they use sauropod vertebrae in like the desert. Yeah, it does have that kind of look to it. And they did find quite a bit of the animal. So they had the pelvis, basically all the bones of the hips, 23 presacral vertebrae, which are only missing the last two small vertebrae that connect to the skull. But unfortunately, they're also missing the skull.
Oh.
Yeah. I was imagining them preparing this out of the rock and thinking like, oh, we're going up the vertebrae. We're getting to the good stuff.
Yeah. And then you get to the head.
Yeah, the very end. And then you're missing the head. It was actually nicknamed Ichabod Craneosaurus.
Because it's missing the head.
Because it's missing the head.
They have to put a pumpkin in place as a substitute.
They did not know. I think you might have mentioned Ichabod Craneosaurus before, or Ichabod Craniosaurus. It doesn't really matter because it's not a real name anyway. But I guess they decided Shri was a better name than Ichabod Craneosaurus. It's a little bit of a mouthful.
I can think of so many depictions of Ichabod Crane that ranges from this more ferocious characterization that they might be going for and also to goofy. Just depends.
I always see him as like the ferocious headless horseman guy.
I feel like I've seen goofy characterizations, but I can't remember in what context.
Yeah. I feel like Shri Devi is a more ferocious character than even the most ferocious headless horseman could be. But fortunately, they did find other stuff in addition to just those vertebrae and hips. They also found vertebrae from the sacrum, back, and tail. And they found what they describe in one place as a partial right hind limb, which I don't think is really doing it justice because I think it's just missing a tiny bit of toe and ankle bones. It's got all of the claws and they're preserved. articulated. So they're all just like basically in the position it was in when it died, it looked like. And oh man, they look so cool, especially that crazy long one, which is right on top of the fossil too, the way they prepared it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just, oh, it's so cool. And then the rest of the leg too, you can get all the details from the different foot bones and the legs and everything. It's a really cool find. Another benefit of Shri is that other dromaeosaurids from the area have what's described as extensive arthropod scavenging.
What does that mean?
So basically, there were bugs chewing on the bones and messing up the fossils for later paleontologists who are trying to interpret them.
Darn bugs.
Yeah. That was especially problematic in between the vertebrae. So they would get in between the centra and chew on, I guess, the ligaments or tendons or cartilage or whatever was in there and inadvertently damage those articulation points in between the vertebrae,
mm-hmm.
which is one of the spots we'd like to look at to identify groups of dinosaurs.
Maybe those are the most tasty bits for the bugs.
Yeah, I'm wondering too if the rest of it had already been eaten off by other larger animals.
Mm-hmm.
And so by the time that these little bugs got around to it, that was the only stuff that was left. And then maybe they had strong enough bite force that they were actually chewing through some of the bone too. But fortunately, Shri does not have that problem. It's got well-preserved vertebrae, so they can see some of those details of how the vertebrae articulated that was missing in other finds.
Well done, bugs, leaving that one alone.
Or maybe it just got buried faster or something.
Yeah.
The authors also call Shri the first unequivocal dromaeosaurid from the Barun-Goyat formation. And that's because there's only one other probable dromaeosaurid from the formation. And I say probable because it's a little bit debated where it sits, if it's like a dromaeosaurid or if it's slightly more basal than that or where exactly it is. But it's probably some sort of dromaeosaur. Unfortunately, that one is only known from a single foot. So obviously this one has a lot more information to go by since it's got the leg and the whole vertebral column basically and the hips.
Mm-hmm.
Which makes Shri a lot easier to place phylogenetically. And it came out in its own group with Velociraptor, just the two of them paired up in, as sister taxa in a group.
So Velociraptor was in its own group alone for this whole time?
I don't know. I mean, the whole thing with these phylogenetic trees is you just dump all this data mm-hmm. into a computer. And then when you add a new species, a lot of times things change a bunch.
Right.
So depending on who did it, Velociraptor might have been in its own group. I think I've seen Velociraptorinae as a sort of group with like five or six that are sort of at the same level of derived status and like the same node. But in this case, it came out as just Velociraptor and Shri as the most common in that little separate outgroup.
They're sister taxon.
Yep. So that's why when you were saying you think it looks like Velociraptor,
mm-hmm.
it does look a lot like Velociraptor. They took some effort to explain, like you always do in a paper, why it's different than other dinosaurs. And most of that was about how it's different from Velociraptor. And it was basically like there's a bump and a ridge that's different on Shri than it is on Velociraptor. But then when I was reading some of the other details about Velociraptor, there's also differences in those proportions of different leg and foot elements. And there's quite a few differences.
Mm-hmm. Enough to justify.
For sure. And they also might have even lived millions of years apart.
Yeah, which also helps.
Yeah, it depends on exactly where they were in the formations, but it helps to show that there's more diversity of raptor dinosaurs in that area than previously known. Just a really fun last aside. The paper references MAN, like with periods in between it, as like a three-letter abbreviation
mm-hmm.
a couple times. And I was like, what is this man that they keep referring to? Is this some kind of like scientific technique that I'm not familiar, you know, and they picked a clever acronym to go with it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm pretty sure it's Mark A. Norell because he's one of the co-authors. And it just made me realize he has excellent initials. I never realized his initials were man before.
Yeah. Well, that works out.
It's enjoyable. This episode is brought to you by Rosetta Stone, the all-in-one language app.
How many ways can you say dinosaur? There's dinosaur.
Dinosaurio.
Conglong.
Dinosauro.
Okay, it's not enough to be able to say one word in multiple languages, but it is a fun start. And it's the start of amazing adventures, which reminds me of when we got to travel to Italy. In addition to all of the delicious food, we had the chance to check out the Natural History Museum of the University of Pisa, which has some pretty cool dinosaurs on display, including a replica Carnotaurus, which is known for having arms shorter than T-Rex and horns on its head, and it's identical to the original found in Argentina. They also have a reconstruction of a Saltosaurus nesting plan, and Saltosaurus are those long-necked dinosaurs covered in armor, and a really special gallery that shows the evolution of whales.
Oh yeah, I love the whale evolution. Yeah, we rented a car to go to the museum, and it helped to know some Italian to navigate around Italy, not surprisingly.
Mm-hmm.
I've been studying Italian for a little bit now, and it's a wonderful language. One of the coolest things about it is it's the modern version of Latin. So with dinosaur names, a lot of times the words are already familiar.
Not just the names, but like parts of dinosaurs.
Very true.
So enter Rosetta Stone. Learning languages really opens up the possibilities for adventure. And Rosetta Stone has been the expert in language learning for 30 years. It's designed so you can learn languages in an intuitive way and you remember your skills long term. And it ensures that you can pronounce each word.
And the best part is, if you join now at rosettastone.com/dino, there's a special offer just for our listeners, and you can get more than 50% off lifetime access to 25 language courses. Again, that's rosettastone.com/dino, D-I-N-O.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's B-Y-T-E.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
And up next, I've got an article that delayed our publication time by a little bit because it was embargoed till 11 a.m. Pacific time, the day we released this, mm-hmm. and the time we released this, if I did my job right. It's hot off the presses. Breaking news, one might say.
Ooh, we're doing breaking news in this episode.
Yeah. Yeah, I like it when we can do breaking news.
We don't always.
Makes me feel like a real journalist. Yeah, it's not often that we could do breaking news when it comes to dinosaurs, but when we can, you gotta take advantage.
Mm-hmm.
So this breaking news is a close look at teeth of Jinyunpelta.
Mm-hmm.
You may recognize the name Jinyunpelta. It's an ankylosaurid, which was around about 100 million years ago in eastern China. And this specific study was published by Tai Kubo and others and published in PLOS One. Open access for the win.
It's ankylosaurs. It's open access. What more do you want?
Nothing. That's why I'm talking about it.
It's missing a sauropod. Anyway.
You've had plenty of sauropods. So this Jinyunpelta, it's known from several individuals, but the specimen in question has teeth which are preserved in both dentaries, which are the lower jaw, and in the maxillae, which are the upper jaw. But unfortunately, the maxillary teeth are all broken or missing. And so we're mm-hmm. really looking at the dentary.
Mm-hmm.
The dentary is also missing the front. So all the teeth are from the back of the jaws. But I think in a lot of ankylosaurs, that's where the teeth were anyway, because they have a beak in the front. I'm not sure if all of them. I think they presume that most of the teeth were closer to the back in Jinyunpelta. So we're probably not missing that many teeth, fortunately. And the teeth that we do have, there's only about 4 of them that have the microwear, which is useful for all the detailed analysis they want to do. But that's still a 4-set sample size. That's not that bad.
Yeah.
A lot of times we're working with just 1 in paleontology. 4 is better than that.
Mm-hmm.
4 times better. If you're not familiar with ankylosaur teeth, they have a very interesting shape. They're usually described as leaf-shaped, which I always think is just a terribly vague way of describing, because there's so
many leaves come in so many shapes.
Yeah, like what leaf are we talking about, right? Is it like a maple leaf? Is it like a cycad leaf? Like a leaf could be any shape. And they don't even look, I don't even know what leaf it's supposed to be, because it doesn't look like a leaf to me. To me, it looks more like a fingernail with ridges on it. It's sort of like a semicircle, mm-hmm. but like a little bit oblong, just like a fingernail, basically.
Okay.
I think another better analogy than a leaf is probably a handheld fan. So like if you think about like one of those Japanese fans or other handheld fans that you fold out and then they have little ridges on them.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically what these look like. Except they're a little bit taller than they are wide, whereas the fans are a little bit wider than tall.
Right.
So I'm sure there's some leaf that is shaped like this tooth, but it's just, I don't know.
It's probably more common than we're thinking too. Whatever the leaf is that it's meant to be shaped like.
Maybe. I don't know. This is always the shape they're talking about when they say leaf-shaped teeth, though.
Mm-hmm.
It's always that same sort of rounded, but like not a full semicircle. And then there's always ridges on it. There's always serrations. In this case, there's about 8 or 9 ridges or serrations or denticles, whatever you want to call it, on the tooth. And it's a small to medium-sized tooth, about 6.5 millimeters across or about 1/4 inch, which is, you know, it's a small head, basically. They got a couple dozen of these teeth, so it's not that small of a tooth, but yeah, pretty small tooth. The teeth have what are described as steep wear facets that cover most of the tooth. So sort of along on the dentary, since pretty much all dinosaurs have bites like ours, where the top teeth go around the bottom teeth. They don't have an underbite going the other way.
Mm-hmm.
So in this case, the wear comes from the top teeth coming down around the teeth in the jaw. So it's on the cheek side of the teeth, and then it's steep. So it kind of wears down the side of the tooth. So they're occluded, it's called. You might have heard of that.
Yep.
If you needed braces, I had very badly occluded teeth. They're running into each other too much, so you get braces to fix that. But if you're a dinosaur and you can replace your teeth all the time, occlusion isn't necessarily a bad thing. It might help you shear vegetation better,
mm-hmm.
which is what we think ankylosaurs were doing.
I wonder how many dentists have studied dinosaur teeth.
Yeah, like done a little paleontology in college
mm-hmm.
on the way to med school. Yeah. I mean, just in general, I mean, they'd be out of a job, right? Dentists and orthodontists, for that matter, if we had teeth like dinosaurs.
Right, because you would just keep replacing them.
Yeah, no one would even bother to brush your teeth if you got new teeth like every 6 months to a year.
Mm-hmm.
You'd just be like, well, maybe you would just so they didn't smell bad.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't be a major issue for us, I would say. Probably be more worried about the gums. Maybe flossing would still be important. I don't know.
Right. But I was just thinking about the overlap between dentistry and paleontology, which seems to come up more often than I would have thought before starting this podcast.
Oh, yeah, that's true. And especially with mammals, early mammals are like all just studying teeth because that's like the main thing that seems to get preserved for whatever reason.
And I was also thinking how you were talking about a couple episodes ago, structured light scanners.
Mm-hmm.
And how I recently heard from a listener how they were able to recognize this structured light scanner when they went to the dentist.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's funny. So they're scanning inside people's mouths for like designing braces or something?
It was for a crown.
Oh, interesting. When I got a mouth guard recently, they did photogrammetry inside my mouth. I don't think it was structured light scanning.
Hmm.
I mean, it might have been actually. I'm not sure. It was taking lots of pictures, but I guess even structured light scanners take a lot of pictures too
mm-hmm.
in a lot of cases. So it could have been. And then they made a 3D model of my mouth to 3D print the mouth guard. It was really cool.
Yeah, just like they make lots of 3D models of dinosaur mouths when they can.
True. So back to this dinosaur mouth.
All right.
They have these 4 teeth and it looks like they were worn by a combination of tooth to food abrasion and tooth to tooth wear, which is called attrition. In case you're wondering. The orientation of the scratch marks, though, is the really interesting thing about this. So the direction of the scratch mark actually changes as the dinosaur was biting. So as you go farther from the tip of the tooth down the tooth, you see the direction and the little micro wear lines change on the tooth, which is kind of weird when you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
What they found was that the scratches were more vertical, closer to the tip of the tooth, and then they were more horizontal, closer to the gum.
Oh.
Yeah. It's weird.
Yeah. It basically changed direction.
What that means is that the ankylosaur had a biphasal jaw mechanism. It was able to bite in two different directions, like as it went through the biting process.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. There's another ankylosaur, Hungarosaurus, which chewed pretty similarly. We've seen similar dental microwear on its teeth, where it started by biting straight down. You can think of like a T-Rex chomping on prey, you know, just like a regular chompy bite. And then halfway through, the bite of Jinyunpelta and Hungarosaurus switches, and instead of just biting straight down, it's pulling its jaw backward. So like towards its body, basically, mm-hmm. not pushing it forward. And that's called palinal. I remember the first time I heard the word palinal, I think was at a talk by Ali Nabavizadeh, and he was talking about how people use the word propalinal,
mm-hmm.
and it's nonsense because pro means forward and palinal means backwards. So if you say propalinal chewing, it doesn't mean anything because you're talking about going forward and backward at the same time. Like, what does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
So these authors did not make that mistake. Ali would be happy to know. They just described it as palinal feeding. So they're pulling their jaw backwards as they chewed. And that allowed it to, I guess, chew the food a little more precisely than just sort of chomping or just moving in the palatal direction. It could do both simultaneously. That movement isn't really a new thing. It's known in lots of notosaurids, and it's also seen in late Cretaceous North American ankylosaurids. But this is the first time it's been seen in an Asian ankylosaurid. It also pushes back the evolution of this sophisticated feeding adaptation in ankylosaurids by about 20 to 30 million years, because previously it had thought to be a late development in the Campanian, which would put it about 80 million years ago. But then this dinosaur, Jinyunpelta, is like how you were talking about. We don't always have a precise date.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of those where we don't really know exactly how old it was, but it's like 110 to 100 million years ago.
Significantly older.
Yes. So definitely a lot earlier. And the cool thing about that is that now it kind of aligns in time with the first notosaurids that had this type of tooth wear showing up. So it was around that same 100 million year ago-ish time range when they were developing this bifacial jaw mechanism. The authors still think that the fancy bifacial jaw mechanism evolved separately in ankylosaurids and notosaurids. They don't think... Because sometimes when we talk about, oh, we found this earlier dinosaur in one branch of the family tree that shares a trait with a different branch of the family tree, the assumption is, oh, they must have a common ancestor
mm-hmm.
that had that trait. We have some good evidence from earlier notosaurs and ankylosaurids that show they didn't have that adaptation. So we still think they evolved separately.
Hmm.
And the fact that this was able to occur simultaneously, more or less within a few million years, in different branches of the ankylosaur family tree, the ankylosaurids and the notosaurids, it probably means that those ankylosaurs had high evolutionary plasticity, as they phrase it, in their jaw muscles.
Oh.
So basically, there was something about their jaw muscles that made it easy for them to adapt and evolve into this fancy new palatal chewing strategy.
It's good. It probably helped them out a lot.
Yeah, I bet it did, because they diversified quite a bit after that and started to show up quite a bit more in the ecosystem, while sauropods were starting to go bye-bye
yeah.
in a lot of those ecosystems.
I see what you're doing.
Well, it's true. I mean, all these dinosaurs have a complex interaction like that.
But they're all gone now.
That's true, yeah.
Except for the birds.
Yes. All the Ornithischians are gone and all the non-avian Saurischians are gone.
Yep, so... both of our favorite dinos lost.
Yeah. But I mean, I'm glad we've talked about before. I'm glad that dinosaurs are not around anymore, at least the big non-avian ones.
True.
Because they would be very troublesome.
Yes. Even the herbivorous ones.
Yes. Because they probably weren't really that friendly.
They're probably territorial, or, you know, when it was mating season, it could get dicey.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm fine with this.
If you find yourself around their babies, if they were parental in any way.
Yeah. But one last thing about Jinyunpelta. The fact that these notosaurs and ankylosaurs evolved the same sort of jaw mechanics around the same time probably means that their jaws were responding to a shift in plant life, and in other words, their diet at the time.
Mm-hmm.
The obvious contender in this case is angiosperms, or flowering plants, which really started diversifying around that time. But unfortunately, we can't identify the exact food from the tooth wear yet, maybe. I'm hopeful that maybe we'll find a way to identify specific food based on the microwear, because they think some of that microwear is from the food and not just from wearing against other teeth.
Oh, interesting.
So maybe.
It's hard to imagine with flowering plants, because they're so much easier to chew, that they would leave enough of a mark that you'd be able to tell.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm thinking maybe there could be like some of those little tiny spores that can fossilize.
Oh, yeah.
Like jammed into some spot in and around those tooth or something. Or maybe we find some gut contents that match that sort of dental microwear, and it's Rosetta Stone of what those that chewing strategy was like.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
Love gut contents.
They are great.
I don't know why. I think it's just, I like the idea of knowing they were eating, probably enjoying their food.
Yeah, I like ichnofossils because they give you more of like a day in the life feel, like footprints or gut contents or like eggs and details like that, nests.
Yeah.
They make you think of them as like living creatures, whereas their bones feel more just like it got to this, it's like a high score or something. It got this big, it lived this long, etc. Whereas the gut contents is more like, this is what it was up to.
Well, also with the bones, sometimes they just, there was a flood and now they're dead.
Yeah.
So it had nothing to do with their day-to-day life. It was just bad luck. So moving on to other news, kind of going back to raptor news, but more just expanding on what we talked about last week with the Utah raptor and Utah. In Utah, in the U.S., there's progress for the Utah Raptor State Park, which I think we talked about a long time ago now. And the proposal has been approved by the State House. It's now moving through the Utah Senate. So that's good. Seems like it's making progress. And if they have the park, it's going to be around where Utah Raptor was found, the block of Utah Raptor. And that we talked about last week. What I didn't realize is that it's about 15% revealed, which is a pretty good chunk.
I wonder what revealed means.
That's enough to know that there are way more dinosaurs in this block than originally thought.
Like they took off all the easy parts on the outside of the block.
Could be.
But like, I bet they're not 15% complete. It's probably less than that still at this point.
It's probably even hard to estimate how complete you are.
Yeah, because you don't know what you don't know.
So fundraising for researching the block is ongoing, and there's this retired couple in Pennsylvania that's offering to match $50,000 of other donors' money, and apparently they'd already donated $50,000, so this is in addition to their first $50,000, and this matching grant offer expires May 1st.
Cool.
Yeah, so hopefully they raise more money.
Yeah, definitely. I like those matching techniques. It'd be fun to set one of those up sometime. My dream of becoming a dinosaur philanthropist.
we're a ways away, but it's a nice dream.
Yeah.
In other news, Dippy the Diplodocus is back on tour, finishing up its tour after pausing last year. Dippy's going to be at Norwich Cathedral in July, and that's going to be the eighth and final stop of the tour. And just a quick recap, Dippy's made of 292 bones. And then after the tour, Dippy's going to be bronzed and go to the East Garden in front of the Natural History Museum in London.
Huh. I don't know if I... Have you told me that before and I just forgot?
I knew about the East Garden. I forgot about the bronzing part.
Yeah, that's interesting. It makes sense. It rains a lot in London. Mm-hmm. I don't know how long the reconstructed bones would last in the outdoors without being bronzed.
Yeah. Especially they put in so much effort into renovating Dippy.
Yeah, because they redid a lot of it right before it went on tour, right?
Mm-hmm.
Nice. It's nice that it's going back to the Natural History Museum, because I know a lot of people miss it.
Mm-hmm. But it's also nice it was able to go on a mini tour.
Yeah.
Next, if there's anyone listening who plays RuneScape, it's this massive multiplayer online role-playing game, they have three new bosses to fight called Rex Matriarch. And they look dinosaur-like. They got sharp teeth. They come in different colors, look like red, blue, and green. And if you play, killing any of them counts towards the RuneScape Dinosaur Slayer tasks.
Of course. Another game killing dinosaurs.
Yep. So I don't know too much about the game, but based on the name of those tasks, it sounds like there's more dinosaurs.
Hopefully there's a dinosaur that you can do something with other than just slay it. But I kind of doubt it.
But you never know. it is really hard to say without having played that game.
True.
And then last, I came across a dinosaur called Cucumber, who's meant to be this motivational dinosaur on social media, I think mostly on TikTok. I actually didn't see Cucumber on TikTok, but I did watch a couple of the videos after I learned about Cucumber.
Cucumber, like the vegetable?
That's the name of the dinosaur. I think it's because it's a green dinosaur.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. It's a small green stuffed dinosaur. I think a sauropod, but it's got like cute little plates on its back.
So it's one of those make-believe dinosaurs.
Kind of cartoony looking. Yeah. Anyway, Cucumber does things to remind and help people to finish their everyday tasks. You know, like go for a walk, drink some water, take a shower. So a lot of self-care could be another reason why Cucumber maybe is like, you know, some people put Cucumber on their eyes or something.
Oh, when they're relaxing?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a lot of things people are forgetting to do. I know I've forgotten to do some of those things during the pandemic when we're inside all the time.
Yep.
Especially going for a walk.
Yes.
We've had some long stretches of inside only time.
Yeah, we need to get better about that.
Gotta pay attention to Cucumber.
We are getting better, but yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Rosetta Stone, How Language is Learned. We're very fortunate that we've been able to go on many trips together and see tons of dinosaur museums and sites all over the world. Over the years, we've been drawn to dinosaur museums that are pretty far off the beaten path and not typically where a lot of tourists end up.
Unless you're a dinosaur enthusiast. One of our favorites is the Kitakyushu Museum of Natural History and Human History in Japan. They have a time-traveling room, which reenacts the end of the world for the dinosaurs at the end of the Cretaceous, complete with a gorgeous but haunting, extremely long-necked animatronic Mementosaurus. Knowing just a little bit of kanji made it so much easier for us to get to the museum and to even make it to that amazing time-traveling room. It's kind of tucked away. Next time we go to Japan, we'll want to learn and practice our Japanese even more.
Yeah, and Rosetta Stone is a great way to brush up on languages before traveling. Their lessons are immersive, and it's designed to teach you to pick up new languages in a natural way. The lessons are short, about 10 minutes, so you can get them done at any time, even right after listening to a podcast, for example.
Wink, wink.
The best part is you can join now at rosettastone.com/dino, and you'll get a lifetime membership with access to 25 language courses at over 50% off. It's worth $399, but you can get it for just $179, and that's a reduction from last week. They just dropped it for our listeners even more. Again, that's rosettastone.com/dino.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
And now on to our dinosaur of the day, Lesimosaurus, which was a request from PaleoMike716 via our Patreon and Discord, so thanks. Lesimosaurus was a sauropod with a long neck and long tail. It walked on four legs, but its legs were more bent than other sauropods. It lived in the Triassic in what is now Argentina in the Los Colorados Formation in La Rioja province, and it's estimated to be about 30 feet or 9 meters long and weighed up to 10 tons.
Oh, it's a little guy.
Mm-hmm.
Although kind of heavy for that short length.
Actually, it's big for the Triassic.
Oh, it's Triassic. Okay, yeah. That is not that small.
Yeah.
That explains, too, why its legs were more bent than other sauropods, because the true sauropods later had more of an upright stance, whereas, like, I guess Lesimosaurus, also Ludumahati, and Lufungosaurus, all of that more, I don't know, sauropodomorph, slightly less upright stance look to them.
Yes, but, well, what's really interesting about Lesimosaurus is because it was large for its time, but its legs were more bent, that shows that it grew in a different way from these other later sauropods, Diplodocus, Brontosaurus, Giraffatitan, that kind of stuff. And what's interesting is that those sauropods, the later ones, grew really quickly, and it was thought that their body structure helped, like having these column-like legs to help hold their weight.
Mm-hmm.
But Lesimosaurus, on the other hand, their bones grew in these quick, short bursts. So totally different, but still managed to be very large, especially for its time.
Yeah, that reminds me a lot of Ladumahati, with the same sort of slightly more sprawled position of the limbs, but still very heavy and big. I think Ladumahati was slightly larger because it was about 12 tons, but it was also later. I think it was right after the Triassic-Jurassic boundary.
Yeah. So Lessimosaurus also had tall neural spines. The type and only species is Lessimosaurus sauropoides, and it was described by José Bonaparte in 1999. The genus name, you might recognize it, is in honor of Don Lessim, and the genus name means Lessim's lizard. And Dino Don Lessim is a pop science writer, founder of the Dinosaur Society and the Jurassic Foundation, and CEO of Dino Don Inc., which makes animatronic dinosaurs and other creatures. So you might have seen his name out there. Bonaparte first described this as an unnamed advanced prosauropod in 1986, and then later named it Lessimosaurus in 1999. And when he named and described Lessimosaurus, he described the 8 presacral neural arches, the tall neural spines, and said that there were other fossils probably associated with it. So that means the holotype is only these 8 presacral neural arches. Then in 2006, Diego Pohl and Jaime Powell described more Lessimosaurus fossils, including parts of the vertebral column, the pectoral girdle, forelimb, pelvis, and hind limb. These fossils were from multiple, probably 3 individuals. So that means they had some duplicate bones. So I know, okay, this definitely came from more than one individual. And they were all found in an assemblage. And this assemblage was probably Lessimosaurus because all of the duplicate bones looked alike and all the fossils in the assemblage were distinct from other sauropodomorphs found in the area, like Riojasaurus and Coloradosaurus. So unfortunately, they couldn't determine the relative length of the forelimb and hindlimb elements because of the diversity in sizes and also disarticulation.
So they couldn't tell which forelimb went with which hindlimb?
Yeah, it was pretty difficult. They just knew there are at least 3 individuals, or probably 3 individuals. But they found a lot of similarities with Antetonitris, which is a sauropod from the early Jurassic in what is now South Africa. Because of the similarities between Lessimosaurus and Antetonitris, there may have been a close relationship between tetrapods in what is now South Africa and South America in the late Triassic, but there needs to be more analysis. The researchers also found derived characters between Lessimosaurus that were shared with eusauropods, the later sauropods, including having proportionally short and high dorsal centra, the back vertebrae, the pubic plate being more than 40% of the total length of the pubis, and a relatively long first metatarsal, or metatarsal 1, belongs to the first digit on the foot.
Interesting. So that must be why it's considered a sauropod and not a sauropodomorph.
Yeah, and it could be why it's so interesting to look at how it grew.
Yeah. Yeah, a little more relevant because maybe it directly evolved, or at least was closer to the same group that evolved into the later giants.
In 2018, Cecilia Alpadetti and others discovered Ingentia and more Lessimosaurus fossils. And before this discovery, Ingentia was a new dinosaur as of 2018, scientists thought that sauropods got so large during the Jurassic that it was linked to eusauropod modifications, like having those column-like legs.
Yeah, and then Ladumahati, too, was also in the late 20-teens that threw that whole hypothesis sort of up in the air.
Mm-hmm. So according to the 2018 paper, this shows that dinosaurs started getting bigger more than 30 million years before the first known eusauropods. So Lessimosaurus is part of the clade Lessimosauridae, and that also includes Antetonitris and Ladumahati.
Oh, there it is.
Yep. So you're right. Dinosaurs that lived around the same time and place as Lessimosaurus include the sauropodomorph Riojasaurus, the Massospondylid Coloradosaurus, and the theropod Zupaesaurus.
And our fun fact of the day is that membrane-winged theropods like E and Ambopteryx were probably only capable of limited gliding and not real powered flight. I'm going hard back into the science after the last week's fun fact that was about topiaries.
I see.
So this is actually from a paper by T. Alexander Dekechi and others. And it's all about that group Scansoriopterygidae, which I always want to call Scansorioterygidae, but apparently it's op, because the P is silent in pterosaur, but then you pronounce it when it's in the middle of a word. I don't know. Latin's hard. But Scansoriopterygidae means climbing wings in Latin, which kind of gives you an idea about what it might have done.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that name was pretty apt, because this recent study shows that they couldn't handle flapping powered flight, and they also couldn't run into flying or do wing assisted incline running. But what they probably could do is climb a tree and then glide from it. So you get that climbing plus gliding. At least E and Ambotarix probably couldn't. That was really the scope of this study specifically.
Right.
So this study was published in iScience, I should also mention, which is open access. And the title is Aerodynamics Show Membrane-Winged Theropods Were a Poor Gliding Dead End.
Oh.
It's pretty harsh.
It is harsh. It's kind of like, well, what could they do?
Yeah. So they used laser-stimulated fluorescence to sort of reinspect this fossil of E and Ambotarix in order to look for the soft tissue traces, because remember, the beauty of these fossils is you can actually see where that patagium, it's called, or that membrane that stretches out to make the wing, you could see that preserved as like this black soft tissue preserved in the fossil. So they had another look at that. And then they also found some traces of feathers that I think hadn't been previously noticed. So they think it might have had some proto-feather fuzz on at least parts of it. And then they modeled the wings in four ways. They did a bat model, which is the one that the original E was sort of depicted with. Basically, it's got this crazy long wrist bone. It's not too different than like if you stretch out your arm and then imagine you have a bone sticking out of your wrist perpendicular from your arm, sticking down quite a ways, and then sort of had like a weird skin stretching from your pinky down to that bone that's sticking out and then back up to like either your armpit or maybe down partway down your abdomen.
Mm-hmm.
So you get a wing from that sort of strategy. That gives you the largest surface area possible, obviously, because the bone is sticking out at a 90 degree angle. And that's basically how bats are. They just have huge, long fingers in their hands that stretch out in that sort of direction. Then the skin comes back and connects back to their body. Thus the bat model. There's the Maniraptorin model, which I think they could have probably just called the bird model, but Maniraptorin sounds fancier. In that one, the wrist bone is stuck back towards the abdomen. It's like basically nearly parallel to the arm. So it's just an acute angle with the arm sort of poking back towards sort of the armpit. So it gives a much smaller wing, but something that looks a little bit more like a bird wing. There's the pterosaur model, where they have that crazy long wrist bone going out parallel to the hand. So just like with a pterosaur, where the pterosaurs have crazy long pinky fingers, basically, is the end of their outstretched wing. That would be the same in this model. And then they have the frog model, which I was like, what frog are they referring to? Basically, it's just webbing between the fingers and the long wrist bone. So if you have like your five fingers on your hand and then you stuck another bone out from your wrist to make sort of like a sixth finger and then stretch skin in between all of those, that's their frog model. And then I looked it up. There is an animal called the flying frog. It's also known as the gliding frog. It's in Planet Earth. I totally forgot about it, but when I rewatched the video, it looks vaguely familiar. Basically, it's these frogs climbing, and then they jump out and they splay out their hands and feet.
Oh, yeah. That does sound familiar.
Yeah. It doesn't really look like it's enough to fly very far or glide that far. I guess it's just a little bit more than a 45-degree angle to the ground, which is enough to be considered gliding. That's like the threshold of falling versus gliding. It's just enough to be considered gliding. And obviously, that one gives you a pretty small surface area and isn't really as good for gliding. What they found was that the bat and bird models were the most likely, given the skeletal details. Basically, if they were in one of those positions, they'd be likely to be able to fold their wings. And it also gave them roughly the right amount of surface area that they would need in order to glide. So the most likely is the combination, what they call the mixed bat and maniraptor and model, sort of in between what a modern bat and bird are like. In that there's skin between the long fingers, but also between the fingers and the wrist bone and the abdomen.
Hmm.
And it also includes some proto feathers on the skin, which might make it a little bit more like a maniraptorin than like a bat, which doesn't really have much fluff on it, at least on the wings. But the key really to why it wasn't a good flyer was the other differences in the bodies that made them less capable of powered flight. Most importantly, there seems to be a very clear lack of powerful pectoral muscles.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have a big, strong chest, you can't flap your arms and you're just not really going to be able to fly. You can glide, but you can't fly. It's just like people. We can glide, but we can't fly.
And we need help gliding.
Yes, we do. We need a lot more help flying, though. All this means that E and Ambotarix would have been worse flyers than either Archaeopteryx or Microraptor.
Wow.
Yeah, and those aren't generally thought of as like really amazing flyers either.
Yeah. Yeah, Huxley thought of Archaeopteryx as this link between birds and dinosaurs, and then Microraptor, we've talked to people who have talked about how it used its feathers for brooding purposes, not mm-hmm. necessarily flying or gliding. So
at least the hind limbs. I can't remember exactly with Microraptor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But it turns out both Archaeopteryx and Microraptor were after E and Ambotarix. So maybe it's not too surprising that later on something was better at flying. But it's not all bad for E and Ambotarix. Apparently, they were pretty well suited for short flights between trees in a forest canopy.
Hmm.
And I was reading about other animals that can glide. And they talk, people that study this talk about how it's a pretty common adaptation, actually, in lots of different types of animals. There's the flying frogs. There's all sorts of mammals, and just tons of stuff learns how to glide because it's really energy intensive to climb all the way down a tree, go over a few feet, and then climb all the way back up a tree.
Mm-hmm.
It's really nice if you can just evolve an extra flap of skin and jump those few feet, and then you don't have to do all that trekking up and down so much.
It's better to get away from predators, too.
Oh, yeah. It's great in all sorts of ways if you're just hanging out at the tops of trees and you don't want to be down on the forest floor at all. And since you don't have to evolve any new muscles or new bones or anything, you know, it's usually just like a webbing or something to that effect. It's, I think, a little bit easier to pop up in all these places. But for E and Ambotarix, anything longer than a short flight would have been tricky. And the authors point out potentially dangerous with hungry pterosaurs around. And if you're gliding, it seems like you're pretty open prey because
you can't change your speed at all.
Yeah, you can't really change your direction that much either. You're sort of stuck on that trajectory once you start out. So yeah,
you become a good snack.
I think so. Yeah, it'd be pretty easy pickings. As a result, in addition to that, it was even worse because the authors point out they were less skilled gliders than the gliding mammals were evolving around the same time. I didn't realize gliding mammals were getting their start way back then. This was about 155 million years ago.
Anything they could do to stay ahead of the dinosaurs.
Yeah. Yeah. And staying off the floor when there's hungry dinosaurs down there is probably a good move. Stay up in the trees.
Mm-hmm.
And then ultimately, pterosaurs were already pretty capable flyers. And then maniraptorans shortly thereafter became better flyers. And that's sort of the dead end. Or another way the authors put it was a failed experiment in pre-bird theropod flight. It was like...
They tried.
Yeah, and it worked. I mean, I think failed experiment is a little harsh because Scansoriopterygians were around for about a 10 million year period in the late Jurassic. So it's not that bad. 10 million years is a pretty long time.
Yeah.
As far as we know, they were mostly in Liaoning, China, in northeast China. So they seem to be pretty isolated in both time and place. So yeah, it doesn't seem like it went too far. And then they seem to disappear around 155 million years ago, which was about 5 million years before Archaeopteryx showed up and about 30 million years before Microraptor was around. But there were lots of other early birds and enantiornithines and things popping up around that time. So I think their days were numbered sort of from the outset on this strategy of gliding. But I mean, even now, you know, there's still plenty of gliding mammals all over the place, and we've got some really capable flying birds. I guess they just didn't quite have a niche carved out that was different enough from those flying animals and those more capable gliding mammals.
Mm-hmm.
So they couldn't find a spot to stick around.
Yes, thinking like if there's a predator going after them and it's between Amblyterix, an E, and a gliding mammal that was better at it. All it would take is for the gliding mammal to be just a little bit faster.
Oh, I see. Yeah. In that sort of direct getting eaten style of evolution, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking like mammals might be able to just get from place to place more efficiently and gobble up all the food before they could get to those places.
Could be a combination of things then.
Yeah.
And that wraps up this episode of I Know Dino. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe to us in your favorite podcast app so you don't miss out on any new episodes. And join our community, patreon.com/inodino. Thanks again, and until next time.
Good day.